Really?
Do not put in Dropbox.
What?
They have a rental that you can't put in the Dropbox for some reason?
Silly.
That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And I'm sure that we don't even know what's on there.
Who knows?
Okay, welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, it's Ian, Joshua, and Matt from 1990. We're talking about Jacob Ladder.
Ian, Josh, and Matt from 1990.
We're in 1990. Yeah. I'm only 9 years old, though.
That means I'm four.
We're talking about Jacob's Ladder. Now, this is one of those dual things where, because the movie's so old, I feel like it's okay to do spoilers, but it's also kind of not, because a lot of anyone that's listening to a podcast may have not seen this movie or ever heard of it. And I would highly recommend it. If you have not seen this movie, you should see this movie, because we're going to go ahead and just do spoilers, because I think this movie isn't worth talking about unless you can really talk about it. If you're just sort of dodging the issue the whole time, it's either just going to sound really stupid, or it's like you're handicapping the discussion. So just so listeners know, check out Jacob's Ladder from 1990 with Tim Robbins, if they haven't yet. Or just listen to the podcast with the spoilers and then see it and lose a little something. I think if you this is one of those movies where you see it once without knowing the ending, and then you see it again knowing the ending, and it kind of has different elements, and you catch different things. So the plot for Jacob's Ladder starts off, you get the Apocalypse Now style the choppers, you're in country, they're in Nam, a whole group of guys kind of buddy-buddy and just sort of taking it easy between, you know, raids or whatever's going on. And then shit just starts going down, and it's very chaotic. There's no sense of who is doing what to who. It just becomes very bloody and kind of gruesome and gory and a little bit melodramatic. And then it cuts to Tim Robbins dressed as a post office worker in a dingy subway. Presumably this movie is set mostly in New York City in, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. Really, you know, like 10 years before it was made. But so New York is that total dingy the way that it was back then, which I think works well for it. It makes for it lends itself well to all the sort of horrific imagery that you get, at least in certain places, and the general just kind of effect of being like in a crappy apartment in a crappy city, that kind of thing. You find out that presumably you just get the sense that he had these experiences, you know, in the war, and now this is 10 years later, or this is whatever years later, and he's living with a woman, he's divorced, he had some kids. One of his kids was killed. It was a tragic thing that probably led to the divorce. He had a degree in philosophy. Maybe at one point he was going to be teaching or had been teaching. They called him professor back in the Nam sequence at the beginning. But he doesn't want to worry about overthinking things anymore, so he just has a job at the post office driving the truck. And that's basically what he tells to his chiropractor, played by Danny Aiello. And then as the story progresses, just more and more sort of bizarre things happen to him, and he ends up in these fits of paranoia. He doesn't know who to trust. He doesn't, you know, and you never really can trust any of the other people. There's something shifty about everything going on. And eventually the script kind of weaves you through this kind of dream within a dream component. And he's got a fever dream, literally, because he has this 106 degree temperature that nearly kills him. And there's an awesome scene where everyone's throwing ice on him and trying to break his fever and save his life. And that kind of serves to explain some of the more bizarre stuff that happened towards the beginning, so the first act of the movie, I guess. And then it goes into it sort of shifts gears and becomes, from being the sort of suspense horror movie, which kind of is in the first half, it becomes kind of this conspiracy theory thriller where he's paranoid, along with a lot of his other former guys from Vietnam, that they're being whacked, they're being killed off to protect some kind of a military experiment or something. That they did something to them in Vietnam. And so as the movie gets to its end, he meets up with this chemist who basically just, in a huge bout of exposition, just explains everything that Jacob wanted to hear, basically. He says, yeah, we did some mind-altering shit to you guys, and that's why this all happened. And that kind of gives you almost a weird sense of closure. It's like, okay, so this is just a story about a guy who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, aided by, you know, these hallucinogenic tests that were done to him, and he's having, you know, acid flashbacks or something, essentially. But then they switch it up on you again, sort of, and you realize that he's not having any of that happen to him. That all of that, I mean, the movie is essentially like the short story occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge and The Usual Suspects, I'd say. In the fact that most of the material in the story doesn't actually happen. It's a story about a guy that's not dead, but a guy that's dying at the moment of dying. He's struggling to, in his brain, to create, to linger onto something, to create something to be alive for and to live for. He creates a whole future with a wife and a mistress and kids and good things and bad things. All of that happens while he's basically dying, having been injured and, you know, wounded severely in Vietnam. And they tack on this text at the end that I think gives it a weird kind of political tinge that doesn't necessarily fit the rest of the film to make you think, well, maybe they really did run some tests on people, and who knows.
The Futile Podcast is brought to you by Trident
Gum.
Hello.
Trident Gum. Hey. And telephone. You know, when I'm doing this at Zach's, he gets like 7 calls in the course of like any podcast in like an hour. It's insane. Maybe it's the timing where we're usually doing them at like a certain time.
Does he do that? You get 7 calls within
an hour? Just his damn wife is calling him 3 times to, I'm doing this, okay. And then she calls him 10 minutes later to say something that changed or something. But yeah, so I'm almost done with the plot and we can really get into the movie. Had you seen this before?
No. Yeah, I didn't know anything about the movie.
Well, what led you to want to pick it to see it? You'd heard about it?
I'd heard about it. I had watched an Adrian Lin director's documentary, and they mentioned it. That and like other things he had done.
Cool.
But I didn't, you know, I don't remember what it was about. Like, they basically talked about the production design and the budget he had and stuff like that. They didn't really go into the plot. So I really didn't know, anything about Jacob's Ladder except the origin of the title, Jacob's Ladder, which comes directly from the Bible. I had a very broad Christian upbringing, and I learned a lot of this stuff. And essentially, Jacob's Ladder in the scriptures is it's a man named Jacob, and he has a conflict with an angel, and they fight, and there's like a ladder, like a physical ladder to heaven. And it's essentially a metaphor for the struggle to heaven.
Yeah.
So I went in it with that mindset, and having that, I figured out the ending in about the first 45 minutes. So it wasn't a surprise to me necessarily. I mean, and I'll tell you where I figured it out exactly. It was when he was at that party, and he was talking to the palm reader. And the palm reader said, "You're already dead." And then at that point, I said, okay, they keep showing these Vietnam flashbacks. He's probably dying, and this is probably his descent into hell. And then right after that, he goes into this fever dream, and while he's dying in that, he's in this picture-perfect home, his wife is there, his kid, who we've already established was dead, is alive for whatever reason, and it looks like he's in paradise. He couldn't be happier. So then I was like, okay, so it's this battle between him going between heaven and hell. They put a different twist on it, how hell is not a punishment, and once that's burned away, you'll go to heaven.
Well, I think that
I did figure it out, and
They remove that religious component. There's a lot to it.
They even try to throw you off by calling the drug ladder.
Yeah,
but it didn't work for me because by then I already knew what they were doing.
I thought that was kind of hokey. I honestly would the palm reading scene. I would completely have cut out of.
I would have cut that out too.
Too on the
nose. It was very. If they hadn't have done that, I might have been confused to the end. But because they did, I still liked the movie, but it was predictable.
Yeah. No. I feel the same way. I when I was a kid, I saw this movie when I was like pretty young, and I think I missed like the first 10 or 15 minutes.
Which is pivotal.
Which is, yeah, exactly. And so I was really bothered by it because I think what it's doing, and you see like the signage, everything like kind of has a purpose. It's one of those movies where everything has a purpose. He's reading The Stranger in the subway, you know, like the Camus story.
There was a poster that said hell.
The poster said hell. The poster said ecstasy.
And there's these random demons. So
And the fact that he was a philosophy guy and had all these books, you know? Yeah. You only get that he's Jewish. It's very, very faint, but they mentioned, the dog tag says it.
But no, that someone also mentioned something about a bar mitzvah.
Oh, maybe.
I think it was Jezebel. Yeah. But yeah, Danny Aiello, I mean, obviously was his guardian angel through all this.
On some level.
And he even called him an angel in the movie.
Exactly. So, it's got a few on-the-nose moments.
There's religious overtones, and you can't ignore that with a movie called Jacob's Ladder, because obviously that's where they got the concept from when you're dealing with heaven and hell. And you know, in the end, the last sequence with Macaulay Culkin, he's walking up the stairs. That's Jacob's Ladder, him going into heaven.
Yeah, the stairway to heaven.
Yeah.
Here's the stairway to heaven. You know that, don't you?
But yeah, I mean, you know, if they had removed that scene with the palm reader, or if I didn't know anything about the Bible, I probably would. I mean, it says right here, takes you on an intense, horrifying journey with a shocking ending that will haunt you forever.
It did for me as a kid, because I didn't know anything about the Bible, and I missed the first few minutes.
Yeah, so...
And now, like, seeing it with a lot more knowledge about films and how things are stories are structured, and the elegance of how to, you know, subtly convey things versus not, I definitely think, yeah, this is a movie that I think would benefit from having about 20 minutes cut out of it.
It took them too long to set up that there was this potential drug that could have been the case. If they had set that up a little earlier, it would have thrown me off the trail. They didn't set that up for an hour?
Yeah, they really did do this. It's like two movies. It's like the whole genre thing of horror, and then they basically tell you what you kind of figure out with the palm reader and everything, and then they switch it up and then try to make you think, no. It's one of those cases where it's like a weird bait and switch, where it's like, it's this. And, like, we're going to make... So the twist is that it's that. It's like, so we're going to tell them that at the beginning, and then we're going to go in a completely different direction to make them think that it's not that at all.
I kind of wish it did it in reverse. Do the conspiracy theory in the beginning.
And then slowly start building.
Yeah, I think that would have been... It would have thrown me off, because then I'm like, oh, so maybe the government's in on this. But by then, it was like, I know what you're doing, so I...
Well, I don't know. I mean, because they throw in that dream within a dream with the fever dream, that is kind of where they break the two genres, where it becomes the second genre of movie toward it.
I just interpreted that as like maybe he won't go to hell, maybe he'll go to heaven.
Yeah, I mean, so. you're right. If you've got that kind of background in understanding cinema, and in your case, in understanding the religious overtones, then I think you're not going to be as easily duped or tricked. I mean, when I was like 10 or whatever and I saw this, having not seen the first 10 minutes, it totally worked on me. And I mean, I think you could lose about 20 minutes out of the movie, because it's just a few places where it's kind of slow, doesn't know quite what it's trying to do with those genres. And I think maybe not so much one or the other, but blend the two a little better.
Yeah.
And certainly, bring the conspiracy stuff in a little earlier for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, like I said, even like the fact that they throw that text at the end just seems like sort of a weird sense, like maybe they were confused at what they're doing. It's like, were they really trying to do a little issue movie here too about like soldiers being experimented on in Vietnam?
Well, it seems like that was obviously the inspiration to write
the
script.
Yeah.
You know, someone probably found that there were these tests going on, and then.
Reported. It says reported, but it never cites any.
I think you're right. I think when they did this, they didn't know exactly what story they wanted to tell, because obviously that was a factor, this whole conspiracy theory, but then they threw the religious aspect on top of it. It worked. I mean, the movie worked. I would definitely recommend it.
That was a loud phone. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Matt is the new Zach.
No, I mean, the movie works. I think it works because of... I mean, it's got a pretty good style. There's nothing particularly over intensely, awesomely stylistic about it, but it falls into that, like, it's a 1990, but it's still sort of technically like within the 80s realm of bizarreness and sort of genre blending and,
well,
shooting, it's on film, it's all these things that now we sort of almost have started to lose. And just by doing that, I think you appreciate it a little more.
Critiquing this movie 21 years after it came out, I definitely appreciated that everything was practical. You know, that's how it had to be back then.
They blew up a car.
They blew up a car. All the demons are actual, probably, puppets from Muppet Studios, or the hell they got them from.
Or just makeup effects.
Yeah, and the makeup was great. I mean, they did a really good job for a movie that came out in 1990.
They pushed some kind of strange boundaries with some of the imagery, some of the grotesque imagery. You know, you got that woman breastfeeding the baby, which is kind of, you've got...
people had body parts that look reversed, but you seemed so quick you couldn't tell.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's definitely just like they... they threw in a lot of creepy stuff, and they sort of, I mean, it's all justified in the fever-dreamed death thralls of this guy's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, I mean, that's the thing that just, when it says in the back, an ending that will stay with you, it really does stay with me, because, I mean, I'm not particularly, I'm not a spiritual person or a religious person, but to me, the idea that, I mean, your brain is what you are. It's how you perceive everything happening, be it real or not real. And so, for both issues of mental illness and paranoia, schizophrenia, dreams, all of those things are all this weird thing. And so it's like no one really knows what it's like to be in the process of dying until you are in the process of dying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great unknown, but it's also a great sort of primal fear for everybody to have. And it's that, well, maybe there is no such thing as an actual biblical hell, but if your brain is in the bad place when you're going out, then if that's how you end, then that's how you end.
Yeah.
And your mind can't perceive time necessarily in the best way.
You can overlay it too with that drug, because he said that it's putting you on a bad trip.
Yeah, exactly.
And your brain goes out of control.
Everything, but it's like you can see all these things from the movie are just his brain. It's all just his brain working these things out, like the desire to have had a family.
Yeah.
But then that sort of duality with like also the sort of the more sexualized relationship that he has
with Jezebel.
With Jezebel.
Yeah.
And then just the general paranoia of what's happening. You know, it's like why the quest for answers to unanswerable questions, sort of like, you know, why am I dying? Well, you know, you got stabbed in a war. It's just that simple. And they kind of do that at the end. It's like, it's just that simple. This guy is just one guy of many, and the guy grabs a piece of paper.
I don't even know if that drug happened. I mean, it could have actually been the Vietnamese person who stabbed him, and he just had this whole hallucination.
Yeah, the whole thing it's got that cop out. It's
they purposely don't show it to you. So yeah, I you could take it either way, but because I mean, he wouldn't have that information dying in a Vietnam.
No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't.
Know,
and that's
emergency
the
room.
He would create. He might create that.
All of
story
it was a hallucination.
As he's dying.
It was a bad trip going into the afterlife. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the real frightening thing to me. At least as a kid, that was the horrifying thing was the idea that.
No, just going
this,
off the
this
back
whole,
of this,
whole
I think.
Story happened in his mind. He created all of this in his mind as he died. And that if that's the sort of thing that can happen to you at the end, that's horrifying. You know, we already know people go out in various ways. People, you know, dementia, if you live long enough, Alzheimer's, not that everybody dies that way, but when your body breaks down and your mind breaks down and your perceptions and your memories and everything start to go, it's just a fundamental fear.
Yeah.
And that's why, to me, the movie has stayed with me for a very long time. It's the same with the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. It's because I feel like I'm one of those people that would try to be a survivor. And then at the last moment, I feel like this would happen to me if I were on that table dying. My brain would be writing a story, trying to come up with solutions to things that I just can't do. I would be fighting this futile struggle at survival. And what Danny Aiello says about, you know, angels and demons, if you're fighting it versus if you're letting it go, it's like, well, the thing about death is that you kind of, if you fight it, maybe you can win sometimes, but not always, you know? It's like if you're only injured, you know, you're gonna die or you're not gonna die, but there's a window there, you know, where
I think in this case it was a mortal wound.
Yeah, it was.
So there's not, you know, you can fight, but
you can fight, and that's what he did. They even say that at the end, like, man, he fought like hell.
Hell of a fight, yeah.
And that's, I don't know, that to me like grounds mortality in a much more profound way, and grounds, I mean, in a weird way, it's like a secular explanation for like a moral living. Because if you lived a good moral life and you have peace of mind within your life in general, then at the moment that you were dying, most of your memories and most of your thoughts and most of your, you know, belief systems and everything else would give you a good trip on the way out. You know, it's almost like why live a morally good life? It's like, so that way you've got a morally decent brain to have a nice dream when you die, as opposed to a horrible twisted nightmare filled with all kinds of, you know, regrets and fears and paranoia and everything else.
Well, some people say that's all death is once you get to death, you're just reliving the memories.
Yeah, so. You know, that's probably very reasonable. I mean, like I said, no one knows those things, and it's not like they really can bring you back and everything. But I mean, traumatic events are like that. Like I got hit by a truck, and I have just moments of that I remember of screaming and yelling, being on the road, being on the ground. It's very cinematic like that. It's like, you know, you just have hits, but I don't have any memory of any of those events. I, you know, just things. And so I don't know if either of you have ever had a real traumatic event like that, where you've been hospitalized in an emergent situation, you know, in an ambulance, zooming, woo, wee, wee, you know, all that stuff, getting injected with drugs that you may or may not have had an adverse relationship to, because I think I got like Demerol or something, and I had to dry heave because I hadn't had any breakfast. I vaguely remember that, you know, when the guy's like sewing my eyebrow back together. I mean, all of that stuff happens. That weird, twisted, screwed up stuff because like one, you're drugged. I mean, and he was drugged too, so. Because he was dying, they probably pumped him full of morphine or something. So, in a real-world sense, he was hopped up on something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know if either of you have ever had any kind of experience like that, but kind of emergency haywire mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting topic, and I love the fact that they played with perspective. But just going back to what we were talking about so I can give it a rating,
yeah,
I think it could have been structured a little bit better.
Definitely.
So I'll give it a... I won't even judge it negatively that I figured it out. I won't even say it's predictable. I feel like the majority of audience members would have gone with it as is. So I'll give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah, I'll give it a 4 out of 5. Because of, like I said, I think the structuring things are an issue. I think part of it is that it's like a 21-year-old movie, and they held the audience's hands. I mean, you have movies like The Sixth Sense now and stuff. So mm-hmm. anyone that's seen those now will see this and kind of roll the eyes and feel like they were like, oh, I figured that out really early. Right. And
well, if I was going to judge it based on the fact that I figured it out before the ending and I didn't have that haunting experience, then I'd give it a 4.
Yeah.
No, if I don't judge it based on that.
No. Judge it based on your best way to judge it. Mm-hmm. Matt hasn't said anything.
Matt, you're in the room.
Yes.
Now he's in the room. He's had a couple phone calls. He's
been yes. I'll give it a 4. I had fun watching it. I didn't figure it out till you guys explained everything, really, but... It was very pretty. Tim Robbins was fun to watch. Very talented.
Yeah, really good.
And that other actor, what's that guy?
The music was great.
Music was pretty good.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Okay.
We got to get going.